The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction hosted a discussion recently entitled Inequities Laid Bare, Responding to Challenges of COVID-19 and Beyond. We're going to hear part of that discussion on today's show. Michael Nurse is a harm reduction outreach worker with the Black Coalition for AIDS Prevention and the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs.
I would say that from a perspective of a person of African descent and working in the area of delivering services to people of African descent involved in illicit drug use, there has always been, even before COVID-19, there has always been this two-track approach, I would say, to the delivery of services to people of African descent involved in illicit drug use. And I feel sometimes I look back and I can almost see that with the two, that there is, for the African descent, there is this approach of punishment and just punishment that involves criminalization, imprisonment, and such, while we see other services being developed that seem to be for mostly European-based, European descent populations. And that, for me, is the basis of the inequity. There's systemic discrimination in the delivery of services, and there is a lack of trust of people of African descent accessing services. And there seems to be a sense that the services aren't being delivered that are needed. There's no culturally based services that are being delivered with any intensity or extent. And there is, almost for organizations that are culturally based, there is very restrictive funding, so that those organizations really don't have a life, a sustainable opportunity to live on. And I mean, when we look at things like, and even today, when we look at things such as supervised consumption sites, and we recognize that most people of African descent that I know of within the urban areas use stimulants and inhale those stimulants. And yet when you look at the development of supervised consumption sites, there is an absence of spaces for people to use stimulants. And when we look at safe supply, and again, we look at that the pervasive use of stimulants among people of African descent, the concept of safe supply seems to be directed solely at opiate users. And this presents a concern, because even for people of African descent, the experience of cross-contamination of opiates within stimulants is a big concern, but yet there is no real response to that among people of African descent. To say beyond that, that COVID has just exacerbated this experience. And the sense now is, even as it was before COVID, that there was this systemic discrimination and a sort of a reduced delivery of services within the COVID experience, there's this experience of being abandoned. Because what limited services were there, the disruptions that come with closures, means that no services are being reached. And for most people of African descent, the services really are outreach services. Because with even among people of African descent, there is this massive stigma toward people who use, and a reluctance to engage harm reduction services. So these services are more or less targeting individuals rather than just being broadly offered. And the advent of COVID just disrupted outreach. There is no sense, there is a movement of people to areas unknown. There is no real connection. And in the face of all of this, the real challenging thing about all of this is that among, in the communities of people of African descent, there is no real leadership to address this problem. So we find that we're abandoned by the limited services that we've gotten, and we have no sense of where to go, who to reach out to have this resolved. So the leadership that is needed isn't there. and the support that is necessary isn't there.
That was Michael Nurse. He's a harm reduction outreach worker with the Black Coalition for AIDS Prevention and the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs. He was speaking recently on a panel entitled Inequities Laid Bare, Responding to Challenges of COVID-19 and Beyond. May Catt is a nurse practitioner and addiction specialist with the Thunderbird Partnership Foundation.
So the Indigenous community, they do have leadership, elected leadership in our across Canada. We have over 600 First Nations and Inuit and Métis population. So our community has actually provided some very strong direction and public health measures to protect our people. And they use that, what we call inherent authority or inherent right to self-determination. But this shutdown of their communities where I work, our communities are remote, fly-in, small populations. So the first key decision that our leadership made was to lock down their communities to outsiders, including drug dealers. And the consequence to that, again, was to many people lost their drug supply. And the second thing that they did was they locally set up pandemic teams who were from their community and kind of knew, the workings of the community and how to help. And in some ways, there's a lot to be said about using your innate knowledge and traditional knowledge to be able to support your people through a pandemic. And so our leadership was able to do that. What it did is prevented outbreaks of COVID in our community, but it also ensured that other things were happening, related to not just drugs, but I think when you look at substance use, it's never clearly one substance. So the first thing we did is we created withdrawal management guidelines for nurses and physicians to be able to remotely and virtually provide support to anyone going through withdrawal. And we did that using ancillary medication, but also traditional medication that we have within our communities and our traditional knowledge. In the beginning of the pandemic, we'd certainly seen a peak in some of the overdoses in the urban hubs. The unsafe drug supply, again, in our area is fentanyl. And young men and very young girls were actually dying from overdose of opioids. And again, these opioids, the toxic supply, what they were buying is they lost access to their usual dealers. So they were buying drugs from unknown supply and it was really harming them. We also know that some of the desperation of withdrawal was creating a high rate of suicide for our communities. And these suicides were, again, very dramatic. They were happening in urban settings. And again, nobody could find the solution, I guess, on how to support or identify people who were feeling this desperation. You talk about opportunities. So one of the innovations we created was a 24/7 crisis and rapid access counseling service called NAN Hope. So far, we've been able to reach over 1,500 people, and we keep them in care, virtual care. So over 350 people are connected to counselors, either traditional counselors who can speak the three dialects of our region, as well as traditional healing or Christian counseling, depending on what the client is asking for. We've also looked at, how unkind the history has been to Indigenous people and Métis and Inuit in our country. And I think this gave us an opportunity to start repairing the past. And we use our land-based programming and our healing, all our treatment centers that mostly reside in urban settings were closed. So we had to take our traditional knowledge and the way that we traditional help each other through land and culture-based healing and use that very effectively in our community. I think when you look at harm reduction from an Indigenous standpoint, we believe that that safer supply can certainly provide a lot of support while we are repairing this pass and while we are dealing with some of the legacy of the residential schools. We also know that, BC has put in an application for decriminalizing, getting a federal exemption for decriminalizing possession for personal use. And we also look at the amounts of drugs that should be provided to people who use drugs for a longer period of time. So this thing of daily, going to a pharmacy daily to get a medication puts you at risk for COVID-19. So, there are some measurements that look at, what is a safe supply, a 3-day supply, so you don't have to constantly go and seek drugs, never knowing who your supplier is. So those are some of the opportunities that we have been creating for the Indigenous community. Particularly our northern communities have looked at opportunities. We don't have health services and we don't have hospitals. So we have to look at prevention of COVID-19 and outbreaks very seriously. So whatever authority the communities, the leadership has, again, using that authority, not just to promote public health measures and not just to create a pathway, a safe pathway for healing for people. I think in many ways we're looking at, how can we use our culture to the biggest benefit right now to protect our young people? They seem to be the most at risk for, again, the behavior related to drugs. And, we're doing many things, I think, and that we also want to continue beyond the pandemic. We know that we're doing post-pandemic planning now on how do we help people after what they've experienced. We haven't been able to use our ceremonies, our culture, to be able to gather properly to deal with the deaths that we've been experiencing in our community, including deaths from overdoses and suicides. So in many ways, I think, this pandemic influence in our communities are going to take many years to be able to recover from.
That was May Catt. She's a nurse practitioner and addiction specialist with the Thunderbird Partnership Foundation. She was speaking recently on a panel entitled Inequities Laid Bare, Responding to Challenges of COVID-19 and Beyond. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Leisha DiGiacchino is with the Community Addictions Peer Support Association.
I will begin by acknowledging the unceded Algonquin Anishinaabeg territory that I'm joining this event from. I'm very honored to be in this event with the fellow panelists, and thank you all so much for your remarks so far. I want to share with you some of the unintended impacts we know are being caused by an intersection of access to safe health care, including substance use care and other social determinants of health. And these include changes to people's substance use patterns, increased help seeking by women who are surviving intimate partner violence. There are predicted increases in child harm and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. We know, and has been mentioned, increased substance toxicity deaths, many of which are young men working in trades. And that limited access to peer support groups and other sources of social connection are reported as risk factors for reoccurrence of substance use disorder symptoms. Prior to the COVID outbreak, I was managing my substance use disorder symptoms well with a number of supports in the community. I can say that exposure to some of these intersections here did contribute to me having a reoccurrence in substance use disorder symptoms. I'm very thankful for the rapid modifications made to the community-based services here, including CAPS's peer support meetings, which I'll get into in a moment. That rapid change in practice was very helpful for me and was able to help me stabilize and now manage my symptoms well once again, although there were some challenges, particularly around receiving trauma-based care virtually, but I'm very thankful for the changes made. I want to talk a little about substance use stigma and discrimination. We know substance use is a highly stigmatized health condition, and people with substance use disorders, which are diagnosable medical conditions, are stigmatized more than other minority populations. Now, there are many intersecting stigmas. People who use or have used substances often endure stigma and discrimination when navigating health systems. And that's been established as a barrier here in Canada to accessing effective care. It also increases people's risk for chronic stress and poor coping mechanisms. I mentioned that there are many intersections of stigma. So people who are using or have used substances and also experience structural disadvantage, such as gender discrimination, will also endure additional forms of stigma when accessing care. And so I can mention that women, if they become pregnant and have a substance use disorder, are likely to experience additional forms of stigma when accessing prenatal and substance use care. So it's important for us to acknowledge that structural stigma exists across our substance use care system, and then also others that have been mentioned in some of these UN meetings and education systems, housing systems, corrections, employment, etc. On the note of employment, I do want to mention that one of the very important factors in me, regaining wellness and managing my substance use disorder symptoms, were very understanding employers. And so I really want to encourage with all of this information, but also with the great gift of an understanding employer to substance use disorder, I want to encourage others to look at some of these initiatives and see how they can perhaps inform some additional anti-substance use stigma work. In terms of solutions, CAPSA has responded quite quickly, as I mentioned, with some other substance use care providers. So in terms of limited social connection, peer support is a service that CAPSA provides to secure life and increase people's health. Our peer support meeting is called All People, All Pathways. And the foundational concept honors people's journeys and recognizes that there are many ways to increase wellness. Many people have different paths, and the purpose is to provide a safe environment for people seeking to question their relationship with substances, whether that's as an individual, a loved one, family member, any ally, friend, healthcare professional, etc. And it provides an environment that's safe, free of stigma and discrimination, and we know that that helps people increase their wellness. We also provide substance use stigma education, awareness of substance use stigma, awareness of substance use disorder, and sharing knowledge, products, and leading activities that promote person-first, inclusive language and practices within workplaces. So part of that is recognizing substance use disorder as a biopsychosocial condition, which is quite important because there are others, such as diabetes and cancer, where we recognize that multiple treatment episodes are part of delivering safe and effective care. And it's really important that we begin to acknowledge that the same is true for substance use disorder. I'm very thankful that the resources and treatment services that I access understand that reoccurrence in symptoms are a part of the disorder, and that there is no stigma and judgment or moral failing on my part for having a reoccurrence in symptoms, that the focus is always to increase health, and that I don't fear that I will not be able to access services because I've had a reoccurrence in symptoms, which I can't say was always the case for all the services of access. So it's a wonderful improvement that we've made. I want to mention briefly, in understanding substance use disorder as a biopsychosocial condition, that of course there are sex and gender differences. So we see here in Canada that women are citing stress as a reason for increased drug use more than men are. And this is quite consistent with previous research that shows that women are more likely to use substances to cope with stress, trauma, and violence, including colonial violence. So we're looking towards an inclusive health approach that have structural interventions that respond to the determinants of substance use disorder and acknowledge some of these sex and gender differences. So this can include addressing adverse childhood experiences, which we know are increasing because of COVID-19 containment measures and changes in employment. Addressing the traumatic experience and substance use stigma reported by many women with substance use disorders who are discussing experiencing ongoing trauma from incarceration and fear of child apprehension when trying to access care, substance use care, or care for their substance use disorder. We support equity-oriented approaches by bringing a perspective of people receiving care, and people living well with substance use disorder, and people who have either used substances people who have used substances are now living well. So the potential increase in substance use stigma during the COVID-19 outbreak here in Canada is currently under investigation by Statistics Canada, but we are predicting that there is an increase in stigma. So we're seeking to make institutions and systems more accessible, compassionate. I mentioned some of the compassion that I was shown and how helpful that was for me, and make it safer for individuals to meet their diverse needs and prevent substance use related harms. So this approach really seeks to remove previously mentioned intersecting stigmas experienced by people who use substances or have used substances. Such examples are trauma and violence informed policy and practices, and some gender transformative approaches to reducing women's substance use and addressing some of the contributors, such as depression and experiences of trauma. I want to close by mentioning that we've had success in establishing systems of community engagement from integrated groups of scientists, clinical practice experts, and experts with living experience. We work together to promote comprehensive and person-centered substance use care, and we've really seen great progress in identifying and implementing transformative actions. So I want to close by reminding us to be mindful that we know from international literature that substance use stigma embedded within resource allocation and clinical care can contribute to inequities in healthcare access. So it's important that we ensure that our health human resources dedicated to COVID-19 and treatment are not diverted from substance use care, which we know is in a time of increased need. So thank you very much for allowing me to share that.
That was Leisha D. Giacchino. She's with the Community Addictions Peer Support Association, and she was speaking recently on a panel entitled Inequities Laid Bare, Responding to Challenges of COVID-19 and Beyond. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. While we have time, let's hear part of the Q&A from this panel. The next voice you hear will be that of the panel moderator, Rebecca Jessamine. She's the Director of Policy with the Canadian Center on Substance Use and Addiction.
I'm very pleased to start with the question that has been provided in terms of what is being done to reduce the inequities in service provision of being a young person who uses drugs and the compounded stigma experienced. Now, May, I know that you do work with youth in your community, and I wondered perhaps if you would mind if we started with you, and then we can add comments from the other panel members.
Interestingly, our communities have really embraced our young people, and I think that speaks to how they don't judge people who use drugs, and I think the opportunity for healing in their communities and with their families has been really evident. We have provided access through a NAN Youth Council, and they're actually delivering support work to young people virtually. They're doing workshops and they're connecting with youth. We've been unable to provide, again, education person to person in our high school. So we know that our high school students are also, working virtually in their communities, but they've also been provided opportunities to be involved in pandemic planning. And, we've been able to vaccinate our remote communities from January to just finished, I think, on April the 9th. But I think that whole community effort has provided support to all our young people. And where they have struggled, again, with drug or alcohol or their own personal pain, there has been support, traditional support, community support, but I also think that, they've been given other options. So we've been able to do detox program. That's a community-specific detox program. Multiple substances, again, there's never just one drug that people are going to choose, right? So we do that in a way where we offer ceremony, we offer listening, hearing what our young people are challenged with and supporting that and giving that guidance. So I think our focus is trying to build that core for young people that they feel that they can be in control of their lives, but also in control of the path that they want to take. So that's what I'm seeing as some success in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much, May. Michael or Leisha, would you like to add comments with regard to impacts on youth in particular?
Michael, thanks, Jessica. Thanks, Rebecca. I'm going with Jessica again. I'm inspired by May's description of the services that are being delivered for Indigenous youth. I'm envious to a degree. Such is not the case, I would say, among people of African descent. The ability to focus support on youth is within that same range of the ability to focus support in general. The resources that are necessary, one, to build a response that is culturally aware and able to be sustainable aren't there, first of all. And secondly, there is still this resistance to harm reduction thinking and harm reduction concept that keeps a focus on the need to move forward only an abstinence first approach. And that leads to a lot of judgment. And there are other cultural practices too, such as like not really listening to the voices of the youth and trying to decide for the youth how they could go. And there are experiences that youth are having that leads to substance use, to increased substance use, that are not being addressed. And when you look, and the thing that is painful about it is that when you look at the increased numbers of youth on the streets and the increased numbers of youth seeking shelter, we know that there is an issue. So I would say that what, in terms of being optimistic, what is needed is a willingness and a decision to have leadership from among the people who needs the services and leadership from among the people whose experiences are being addressed. So like leadership within communities, because even youth know what they need, and they're youth with certainly with excellent leadership qualities, but these are not being recognized, these are not being supported. And until that is done, until people are able to voice and take ownership of their lives and what how they would like to lead those lives, as May very, very well put forward, there will be that challenge. So I would say that the opportunity here is to allow people to speak and to lead, speak about and to lead responses to their lives and responses to their needs.
Thank you, Michael. Leisha, would you like to add any comments?
I'll just quickly add that there is substance use care that's available. I know it's been modified in a lot of ways. The Wellness Together Canada portal, as I mentioned, has the All People, All Pathways meetings. One of those meetings is dedicated to post-secondary education students, so I'm not sure of your exact age. There are other resources on that portal as well. I don't know if you're in a city that perhaps has a rapid access addiction medicine clinic, but I just want to convey that there are still substance use care services that are open during COVID, and you may find some help at the Canadian Mental Health Association website. There's a map and you can go to whichever jurisdiction you're living in. I'm not sure if it will provide substance use care available in Indigenous communities, but I believe in non-Indigenous communities, there's the resources listed.
That was from a panel discussion entitled Inequities Laid Bare, Responding to Challenges of COVID-19 and Beyond. And that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.